Hi, I'm Chris Cotnor, executive producer of the DSR Network. We've been incredibly busy here over the past month. With the launch of TNR's Daily Blast, we now produce 10 shows covering foreign policy, national security, domestic politics, cyber and tech, legal, and much more. We've also just launched our redesigned website at thedsrnetwork.com. With all this content, there has never been a better time to become a member. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack community. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. On Monday, the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 that Donald Trump will not be disqualified from appearing on the ballot in Colorado, overturning what that state's Supreme Court had determined late last year. This means that while Trump clearly engaged in insurrection, all legal challenges to his ballot access on that basis are functionally dead. This was expected, but the ruling has a forward-looking dimension as well. Coupled with the court's willingness to hear Trump's demand for full immunity from prosecution for insurrection-related crimes, it raises serious questions about whether the court is functionally placing Trump beyond accountability. It also raises questions about whether Democrats should make a much stronger public case to that effect. Here to unravel all this is New Republic writer Matt Ford, author of a new piece about the ruling entitled, "The Supreme Court Just Blew a Hole in the Constitution." Welcome, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
First, can you recap the ruling for us?
Well, the ruling has two parts. It's about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which states that people who have sworn an oath of office and then take part in an insurrection or rebellion can no longer hold future public office in the United States, whether at the federal level, state level, if they're a dog catcher in Peoria, Illinois, nothing. The Colorado Supreme Court said that Trump fell under these provisions. Trump appealed that decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court released its decision today, and there's two parts. The first part is that states do not have the power, in the court's eyes, to adjudicate these claims for federal office, which means the presidency, House races, and the Senate. That part of the ruling had a 9-0 conclusion. All nine justices, from Sonia Sotomayor to Clarence Thomas, all agree that that was the case. But the court went further than that. And by a 5-4 ruling, this time with the, I hate to break it down this way, but it's the easiest, the five men in the majority and the four women in dissent, the court also held that Congress had the exclusive power to decide when this provision was applied and how it can be enforced. It's a breathtaking ruling. It's one that I've been highly critical of, and it's one that is going to cause some severe problems going forward.
It's being widely presented as a limited victory that the court did not rule that Trump didn't commit insurrection. And yes, that does rebuff Trump, who had argued that January 6th was basically a tourist visit or a protest or whatever. But the truth is, the court failed to state that what Trump did was an insurrection. The Colorado State Supreme Court ruling, of course, did state this. Isn't this itself arguably abdication by the Supreme Court here?
That's one way to view it. I mean, the court had a number of ways that they could have resolved this case. They could have resolved it on constitutional grounds. They could have resolved it on factual grounds. You know, I think that for them, they saw the constitutional grounds as the most solid way to deal with this. When you get into the factual grounds, you get into things as like whether the January 6th report by the House should be counted as evidence. Do you consider some sort of criminal trial to be necessary? You know, you can read the clauses saying no, historical practice is the same. The factual basis raises a lot of things for the court that as an appellate court, it's not used to usually dealing with. It usually doesn't address specific factual findings and reach disagreement on them. So I wasn't really surprised that they went with strictly the constitutional holding, where they assumed, for the sake of argument, that yes, Trump had done this without actually affirmatively saying this. Now that causes other problems. Like you say, Trump did do this. Trump is clearly falling under the terms of Section 3. The problem is now is that the court has sort of removed any practical means by which he can be held accountable for it.
Let's just be clear on this point. If the court had affirmatively stated that Trump did commit insurrection, it would have had a whole lot more difficulty reaching the conclusion that it did, right? The logic would have had to be even more tortured.
Right. And you know, that's one of the problems with a ruling like this, is that it leaves intact the baseline assumption that many people have going in. Legally speaking, you know, you and I and anybody else in the Republic can consider Trump an insurrectionist. The Section 3 imposes clear disqualification on that. You cannot be a federal office holder. It's absolute, unless Congress, of course, lifts that provision, and Congress has not done so.
Right. And Congress has to do that by two-thirds, right?
Right. And so it imposes burdens on other actors to say, you know, this is the way we go about this. The court seems to have anticipated that with the second half of its ruling, the 5-4 part, by putting the exclusive power of determining that in Congress's hands, knowing probably full well, because they read newspapers, that Congress is not going to do anything about that. The chances of Congress passing legislation that would define this further is about as close to zero as you can humanly get.
Right. And so the conservative majority minus Amy Coney Barrett held that states lack the authority to enforce the disqualification clause of the 14th Amendment because only Congress can do it. The three liberal justices dissented from that too. But doesn't this idea functionally gut the possibility of enforcing the insurrection clause in the future? It seems to mean that no state can ever exclude a candidate from the ballot, no matter how blatant his or her assault on the constitutional order was, without Congress passing a law first. Do I have that right?
That's true, with two caveats. The first caveat is that there's sort of a relic of the Reconstruction era that provides a specific method for disqualification if charged with a crime for insurrection. And it's a specific provision of federal law. For various reasons, federal prosecutors did not pursue that against Trump. It raises First Amendment questions. It'd be difficult. So I think we consider that door closed, except in all the most extreme circumstances. The second part is that state officials can still disqualify state candidates. And we've seen that already. We've had January 6 participants excluded from office at the state level, whether in state legislature, usually in state legislative offices, but potentially others as well. The problem, of course, is that, you know, the whole point of disqualifying insurrectionists is that they are unfit for public office. And few offices are higher than the ones in Congress. And of course, the highest of all being the presidency. So you have a situation here where Donald Trump would probably not be able to get on the ballot for governor of Colorado or governor of New York or governor, or maybe even governor of Florida, but he could still run for president because the court has drawn this sort of artificial distinction between state and federal offices.
Right. And as you wrote, for whatever reason, the liberal justices clearly did not want to vote to disqualify Trump. Perhaps they really agreed with the per curiam ruling, perhaps not, I don't know. Do we think that they, whatever they personally thought, that they also thought a unanimous decision would be in the interests of the country? Maybe they bought into the idea that the perception of broad consensus behind the idea that Trump is eligible might have a calming or reassuring effect?
I think you get the sense from how they structured it, because the justices, you know, they may have been skeptical about this argument. They may not have been fully persuaded. It's hard to be, you know, telepathic about what exactly they're thinking. But if you look at how the case is written, they very clearly sided with the court on half of the ruling. It appears the way they portray it is that there was a broad consensus on this one part, on the idea that states can't disqualify federal candidates. And then the conservative majority went further than that. And so the concurrence, which is functionally more of a dissent, the concurring opinion that the three liberal justices wrote really is sort of accusing them of sort of breaching the unanimity that they had. You almost get the sense that they went in on this unanimously, and then, you know, and obviously I don't know this for sure, but the, you know, it gives the appearance that they all agreed to something, and then a few of them went one step further, and that's where the rupture occurred.
Well, it'll certainly be very interesting to see if the court will rule 9-0 against Trump when it comes to the question of whether he has total immunity for prosecution for any crimes related to his insurrection. What do you anticipate there?
Well, I would like to think that the court would be unanimous on the idea that presidents can't commit crimes and get away with them. But then again, you know, you would think that other provisions of the Constitution that spell things out cleanly and neatly would also be, if not more easily read, then certainly give them more hesitancy about reaching broad declarative decisions. You know, I think that when you have a case like this, it shakes your confidence in their ability to get other things right. And I think we'll have to watch a lot more closely at oral arguments to make sure that they are not going to read something into the Constitution that isn't there for that one as well.
Right. And I think at the very least, it's unlikely that the hard right bloc on the court feels any sense of obligation to reach unanimity on that question specifically in order to reassure the country that there's consensus, as the liberals appear to have felt. And I think that speaks to a profound asymmetry here, a deeper one. The hard right justices have been absolutely fine in pursuing their agenda, no matter how destabilizing it is. Indeed, you could argue the whole conservative majority has, right?
Right. I mean, I think the conservative legal movement's goal has been to destabilize. It has wanted to impose its own vision of the Constitution and federal law upon the country. And that requires tearing down and disrupting what's already there. You know, the question was always whether that would extend to things that weren't necessarily in the core of the conservative legal project, things like deregulation, but whether that would also apply to things that would uniquely benefit Republican candidates for office. You know, after today's ruling, the idea that the judges can be impartial in something like that and approach it straightforwardly has taken a bit of a hit.
Yeah, and there's something Barrett wrote that I think is worth talking about. Amy Coney Barrett chastised the liberals for dissenting from the finding that only Congress can enforce the prohibition on insurrection and said the court must, quote, turn the national temperature down, not up. The 9-0 ruling is supposed to persuade the country that there's unanimity on the question of whether Trump is a qualified candidate, right? The per curiam ruling says something similar, presenting itself as the antidote to chaos in our elections. And yet, the kind of unspoken thing lingering underneath this is that nothing introduces more chaos into an election than refusing to accept its outcome and inciting mob violence to overturn it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that if you wanted to really reduce the temperature in American elections, you would disqualify the insurrectionist from public office, or at least step out of the way and let the states do their constitutional responsibility to do so. I think Right. that's the big takeaway here, is that the justices did not have to do anything. This is something that the Colorado Supreme Court could have done on its own. They could have waited for other Supreme Courts to reach different conclusions and maybe tried to harmonize them there. But the court went out of its way to do this. And I think it can't then claim that it's trying to help when it's very clearly trying to impose one side of a vision onto the country by misreading part of the Constitution.
Absolutely. I want to try to uncover a deeper lie that I think is at work here. The fact that the court spoke unanimously is supposed to reassure the public that constitutional democracy is sitting on a firm foundation, that the rule of law is stable in this country. But note that the court said this while refusing to say one way or the other whether an insurrection happened. Only the accounting that refrains from offending Trump and MAGA can be the route to stability in this kind of accounting. Yet this is itself kind of a lie, right? The rule of law is arguably imperiled further due to the refusal to state categorically that what Trump did was disqualifying. I think you said something like this, but if you attempt to overturn the constitutional order, you cannot seek such awesome power under it. And not enforcing that is the destabilizing thing. And they're trying to sell us on the illusion that a unanimous decision of this kind is stabilizing.
One of the most grating parts of, and you just quoted it indirectly there, one of the most grating parts to read of the opinion was the part where he says that, you know, where I assume John Roberts wrote it, but we don't know. The unsigned majority said that the opinion, you know, they didn't want to release a ruling that would, you know, discount the will of the people, that would invalidate the election results. That is assuming Trump's priors as your starting point. The reality is that that's what Trump tried to do. That's the sin that Trump is guilty of. And it's the sin that they are now not only not allowing people to hold him accountable for, but are projecting onto his opponents. It is really striking to see the court adopt that as their starting point for approaching this whole case. And I think it speaks to the broader problem they had coming in with this, where they viewed this entire effort as illegitimate and simply worked from backwards to find a way to get out of it. I think that's one of the most disappointing things, is that here you have a constitutional provision that's never been interpreted before, that you have a literal blank sheet of paper, and the court still got it wrong. It's not only bad judging in the outcome, but in the reasoning. And that speaks to a deeper problem at the court.
Yeah, and it also creates the illusion, I think, that Trump, wittingly or not, that Trump and MAGA didn't pose a serious threat to the constitutional order and still do not. The court essentially evaded saying whether they posed this fundamental threat, but at the same time said in so doing, it is achieving stability in the rule of law. I mean, that's fundamentally itself a lie, I think.
I mean, in a way, it's actually almost slightly worse than that. By not addressing that, they effectively said, hey, maybe Trump committed an insurrection. Maybe he didn't. Either way, you can't do anything about it. States, for some arbitrary reason that is not found in the constitutional text, can't do anything about it. And Congress, which we know is impotent and unable to pass legislation to keep the lights on, has to do something about it. The shell game here is pretty obvious, and it's pretty troubling that the court didn't even attempt to hide that.
Right. And it's doing this under the guise of saying that they are achieving stability in the rule of law. I think you see something similar with the court on the January 6th case, too. The court has agreed to hear Trump's demand for immunity, even though the lower court ruled persuasively and strongly against it. That could result in the trial being kicked until after the election. And we're supposed to believe the court is neutrally deciding this on the law, but the inescapable context here is that Trump will simply cancel prosecutions of himself if he wins, and the voters won't have the chance to weigh in on him knowing if he's committed crimes as part of his insurrection. I think here, again, the illusion the court is peddling is that it can achieve stability in the rule of law simply by being neutral. But the court is either creating a pathway for Trump to put himself above the law, or it will not do that. There's no papering over the threat to the system that Trump and his movement pose.
Right. I think the court has misjudged the situation here severely. And while some of that they can take into account when judging, they very, very clearly have taken into account the opposite side of it, that this is all unfair to Trump, that they're trying to unjustly exclude him from the ballot, that they're denying people the opportunity to vote for the candidate of their choice. I believe I wrote in the piece, you know, if Arnold Schwarzenegger ran for president tomorrow, he would also be denied the opportunity. People who wanted to vote for him would be denied the opportunity to run for the candidate of their choice. The Constitution makes very clear that you can't run for office unless you meet certain criteria. President Trump has very clearly not met those criteria, and the court has now said you can't do anything about it.
And don't Democrats have a responsibility to communicate clearly with the country about all this? Congressman Jamie Raskin told me that if the hard right bloc delays Trump's trial for insurrection-related offenses, it will be functioning as an enemy of the Constitution and the rule of law. You rarely hear Democrats talk this way, but it needs to be stated clearly. The Supreme Court is taking steps that are enabling Trump to pose a fundamental threat to the system itself.
Yeah, I think the problem for the court here is that it is undergoing a broader legitimacy crisis. People have lost faith in it as a neutral arbiter of the law. Some of that started with its perception of decisions on abortion and on other matters before the court. But I think we're seeing that extend into a much more direct partisan area, where it's not just a matter of adjudicating constitutional questions. It's a matter of deciding basic fundamental realities about our politics. And I think that when they sort of ignore things like the insurrection, like the attempted overthrow of our constitutional order, they have opened themselves up to greater criticism. Now, exactly what form of criticism that takes, I don't want to say call anybody an enemy, but I think that they shouldn't be surprised if their, you know, public reputation takes a hit from something like this. When they, you know, they act in ways that, you know, you see a lot of professors read this decision today and they can't explain it. It doesn't make sense on its own terms.
Absolutely not. And you see the same thing with the court's taking of the immunity case, right? I mean, here's a situation where we know that Trump dismisses any and all prosecutions directed at him as inherently illegitimate, and he will use his powers as president if he regains the White House to cancel prosecutions of himself. Yet the Supreme Court is acting as if it's still making a neutral decision on the law, but there isn't a neutral decision here. Either you're helping Trump do this or you're not.
Well, you know, the one thing I will add on the immunity case is that they are technically responding to a motion filed by Jack Smith. So we can't completely eliminate the possibility that they will rule against Trump on this. I know that the delay has caused problems, but the cause is not yet lost on the idea that they will rule that Trump is immune. Now, the delays have been problematic, and those have caused a lot of issues, but the cause is not yet lost there. What I worry about after today's decision is that if you asked me a week ago if I thought if I thought the court was going to be willing to grant Trump some sort of immunity, I would have said no, because, you know, there's no evidence for that in the Constitution. You know, you can read it and you don't see anything about immunity for presidents there. You see it for lawmakers. We have a long common law tradition for judges, but there's nothing there for presidents. The concern after today is that if the court is this willing to play fast and lose the constitutional text to help Trump on this grounds, will they do it on other ones? And so I think the immunity case has to be a lot more closely watched, and it can't be taken for granted that the court will reject Trump's crazy theories.
That is really sobering. I just want to clarify that I'm not saying that the Supreme Court is going to rule for Trump on immunity. I still expect that they will rule against him. All I mean is that the court is acting as if its decision to hear the case at all on its own timetable is being made purely in a neutral way in keeping with the law. And yet either the court is going to function in a way that enables Trump to kick the trial for January 6th related offenses to after the election, or it won't do that, meaning either the Supreme Court will give him a pathway to invalidating and canceling prosecutions of himself, or it won't do that. There is no there's no neutral path forward here that I can see.
Yeah, and I think the court committed a major error when it rejected the opportunity to hear this case before the D.C. Circuit. You know, they had the opportunity back in December to hear this on a much more expedited briefing schedule without the D.C. Circuit weighing in. And I think the assumption when they declined that was that they would let the D.C. Circuit rule and then let that be the final word. You know, it's hard to predict exactly what goes on behind closed doors of the court. They certainly aren't very open about it, except if they're leaking opinions on abortion cases. But, you know, it's hard to rationalize their decision to not take it at the earliest opportunity and then take it now. I think it gives the impression that the court is helping Trump run out the clock on these cases, like you say.
Well, on that note, we should probably call it a day. Thank you so much, Matt Ford. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.